Wow.
Tonight, we get to pick the brain of even the Walking Dead. Would envy. Yes. For us sports-minded folks, for those of us that love the sporting endeavor, tonight, and only tonight, our guest is Brian, the journalist, Williams. I met Brian about, about 20 some odd years ago. Always admired him, and he's a very modest person. I love doing this because this bothers him more than anything. You don't talk about Brian being a nice guy. He doesn't like people knowing he's a nice guy. I'm a journalist. Now, he is a nice guy, and he's nice enough to spend some time on a show like this one, which in all honesty, there probably are thousands like it, but Brian Williams has deemed this show good enough to discuss his career. Not so much his life, but I think I have to, as a precursor, discuss his life. Brian's father was a very successful doctor. Unfortunately, as does happen sometimes, part of becoming successful is having to move around. Now, from what I've read, he's been in places like Inver, British Columbia, New Haven, Connecticut, Edmonton, Alberta, Hamilton, Ontario, where he graduated from Westdale Secondary School, Grosse Pointe Farms, Michigan, Grand Rapids, Michigan, where he graduated from Aquinas College with a BA in History and Political Science back in 1969. I wonder if he took time to go to Woodstock. After graduating, he spent a year as a teacher at Grand Rapids School. He moved on to radio employment at Toronto's CFRB and Chum Radio, where I got to know of his exploits. And where I got to really know about Brian Williams was CBC local CBLT sportscaster. Of course, that meant he was with the Canadian Broadcasting Corporation. Of course, he's been doing stuff, or he did stuff since 1974, till he, of course, moved on. But my favorite program that he did was Sports Weekend, which he was the front man for. And as the front man, unfortunately, you get all the credit and all the blame for a show. It was a great show. It was a great opportunity for Canadians who weren't hockey players. And at that time, baseball wasn't a large concern as far as the general Canadian public is concerned. So a lot of Canadian sports, like skiing, there was no snowboarding then. But all the Olympic sports outside the Olympics, as far as the outside the Olympic schedule, he took a very large part in. And, of course, a lot of international events, such as soccer and other things interwoven within the sports weekend, literally sports weekend. And so they took care of all these kinds of sports. And I really enjoyed watching those shows and watching those athletes that were Canadian. Also, over 25 years ago, he began something called Grapeline, and it dealt with sour grapes, gripes, and snipes with Don the Sartorial Splendor Cherry. And that, to me, was an amazing thing. And back around then, I had the good fortune of having Don Cherry as a commentator for the, I think at the time it was a Midget International Championship Invitational. And I think it was called the Bell Challenge Cup, which eventually became the Esso Challenge Cup. Don Cherry and Brian Williams became a great tandem. And that tandem is basically the root of Coach's Corner. In fact, I think I would venture to guess to say that it was the original Coach's Corner. So he moved on, Don Cherry. Moved on to bigger and better things at Coach's Corner, while, of course, Brian Williams was at CBC and then decided to move to Bell Globe Media, which is TSN CTV, if you will. And throughout all this, he spent decades, of course, as I said, during non-Olympic years and during non-Olympic events, he covered much on Sports Weekend. He also, we have to find out, if he has any memories, I want to talk to him about the 1972 Canada Cup Russia Super Series, which we all, you know. Of course, he's covered decades of the Stanley Cup. In fact, he's well known for a junior tournament that took place where the Russians and the Canadians had a brawl, turned the lights out in the arena. He was there for the beginning of the Toronto Blue Jays. And more importantly, and these are the key and more important thing we need to discuss today, he is and was a CFL broadcaster, a journalist. He's a Hall of Fame inductee, CFL Hall of Fame inductee. He is also a CFL Hall of Fame inductor. He's inducted a few players and other people involved in football. And he is a great journalist to talk to about the CFL Grey Cup and regular season history. And this past year, he was the Grey Cup presenter at the 100th Grey Cup. And he presented here at the Rogers Centre the Grey Cup to the Toronto Argonauts. Now, he should be calling within a few minutes. And another point to be made is that he is one of the old-fashioned journalists, and we hope to find out from today You know what? I'm going to call him. That's what I'll do. What do you think, Carolyn? Should I call him? Why don't I call him? Let's call him, okay? And, you know, I actually told him I was going to call him. So, you know how it is. I have all these important numbers of all these important people that...
Hello?
Oh, you ordered a pizza? It's Frank, Brian.
Okay, Frank.
Okay, Brian Williams, I discussed a few things with the folks that are listening. You have had a great career as a journalist. You've seen some amazing stories develop in front of you. You've seen trends. And if I may, can you please first, as not being a journalist myself, or I wouldn't even consider myself a journalist, not for any reason other than just to say I'm not, define a journalist when you first started and how it's changed to a journalist today based on the fact that we see the blending of TV broadcasters and journalism.
Well, first of all, I didn't used to get called by pizza salesmen. When you called, I'm sort of half asleep here, and I thought I didn't realize we're on the air. No, good to talk to you. Well, I think with media companies owning teams, the line is obviously blurred. I remember Jim Hunt, the legendary writer with the Toronto Sun, sportscaster with a fan in Toronto many years ago back in the early 70s, saying to me, "You never say we." I don't think I've ever said we. And whether I'm doing an Olympics in Korea, a Grey Cup, a hockey game, whatever, I've always tried to separate myself. I have great respect for the athletes, but I'm certainly not part of the show. I've never tried to be friends with athletes or team owners or team general managers. But it has changed, Frank. I mean, 30, 40 years ago, media companies didn't own sports teams. And obviously when the organization you work for also owns the team you're covering, I mean, it is a very different situation.
I mention that because this year the Toronto Blue Jays had their opening day.
Right.
And I found it very, very inappropriate, the opening that they had. We both know that the team that they brought to the field this year that went to, was down south and then came up north for that first game, the opening game of the season, was untested. They had no reason to do what they did. They basically, while the Indians stood on the field, basically trumpeted the greatness of this Toronto Blue Jay team without having done anything. And I maintain that that kind of behavior really makes it hard for the team and the players on the team to win because they're really up against it when you are that, self-promoting.
Well, I was not in the country for that first game, but based on what you've told me, I don't see a problem with that. I mean, teams have their opening nights, have their opening days, and they trumpet what they have and what they've done. And whatever happens with this team, and I'm not defending it or criticizing the trades. I mean, they did get a third of a Miami team that won something like 68 games. But give Alex Anthopoulos, Paul Beeston, and the Jays credit. For years, people in Toronto and Blue Jay fans across the country have been complaining that the owner, in this case Rogers, was not spending money, was not going out and getting players. Well, they got some great players led by Reyes and a couple of pitchers from Miami. And, of course, Dickey, the Cy Young winner in the National League last year. Whatever you think of Cabrera and his problems in San Francisco, he was hitting just under 350 at the time. So they did go out. They made some dramatic moves. And when you read publications, whether it be Sports Illustrated, you know, Baseball Weekly, they were now touted as one of the top teams in the American League. So I don't think there's anything wrong with selling that to your fans when you've got out and done that. When you've gone out and done that, it's a very different, very different situation to deliver it. But, right now the team is below 500. Did beat Baltimore to win one of three games this afternoon in that series. But still, when you begin the season with high expectations, these are expectations not only that you, meaning the organization, are putting on the players. These are expectations put on by baseball experts throughout North America. So I don't see anything wrong with that.
All right, then let's go on the assumption then that what they did was okay. But what happened?
Yeah, I'm not, Frank, I'm not getting into saying what they did or did not do was okay, but give them some credit. And look, I don't work for Rogers. No one's putting any pressure on me, but let's be fair. Paul Beeston and Alex Anthopoulos, people are saying, when are they going to spend money? When are they going to be competitive to Boston or New York? Well, they went out and spent the money. Whether it turns out whether they make the playoffs, that's a different story. But when you're having an opening day, you're sold out. You're expecting sellouts in April, something that has not happened in this city for years and years and years. There's nothing wrong with trumpeting that. You don't think when they have an opening day in Detroit or some of these cities that have high expectations, they do the same thing?
I've seen some opening days, and only as a fan, I don't have the good fortune of sitting in the stands either as a reporter or whatever. Not now, anyway. I did way back when. But the problem I have, and I guess it's basically about being a winner. And, as far as I'm concerned, winners win because, for the most part, they surprise people. A lot of championships are won by teams who sneak up on people, and I just don't think that what Rogers or whatever, who put that show together, I know you didn't see it, so it's unfair of me to even ask you that question, so maybe I should just drop that. Let's move to a different point then in that regard, just to complete the Blue Jay thing for this year. So now the team is starting to have problems. Some people on the radio are saying, it's time to get rid of the manager, like 20 games in. That kind of stuff isn't helpful. But at what point, as a journalist and in your experience, what makes a winning team in this situation? What have some of the teams that have won, that have been in this situation early in the season, what have they done to correct basically the direction they're going in at this time?
Well, you would hope they had a proper plan from the beginning, and you stick with that plan. I've never bought the argument that April doesn't mean anything. Come on, there's, 25, 30 games in April. When you get in December or you get in September and you're five or six games out, those games in April do mean something. But there's no question the start has been disappointing. But to talk about firing the manager, this far,
I don't think that's right either.
Is ridiculous. If you know anything about sport or you know anything about baseball, hockey, football, basketball, it doesn't matter. You have a plan going into the season. And, if you're at the All-Star break and this team's still, four or five games below 500, that's a very, very different story. And, again, I don't work for the Blue Jays. I used to do Blue Jays play-by-play, and I was very critical, probably the most critical play-by-play announcer they've ever had. But they did go out and try to make changes, to spend money, and to better the product. I give them full credit for that. I am not one of those that predicted they would win 100 games by any stretch of the imagination. But still, give them some credit and wait and see what happens. But you're quite right when you set the bar high. you know, you get people all excited. The media get everybody excited in spring training. Well, when it doesn't pan out right away, you got to be prepared for the negative feedback, premature as it might be, and that's happening right now.
Yeah, it sure is happening in spades. I agree with you, at least your inference that the manager should not be fired at this point. It's way too soon, and you're and obviously you're right about having a little more patience, and the fans are going to have a little patience. But one thing's for sure that
I don't
maybe
blame the fans for. I don't blame the fans for being upset. When you set the bar that high, and the Blue Jays set it high, the fans are expecting you to equal that. And when you don't, then you have to be prepared to stand up and take their wrath.
Yeah, or correct the problem and then try to, you know, sidetrack the fact that you have to basically protect yourself against all the bad press, if you will. So let's go back to the beginning. You had the good fortune of we're talking about the Blue Jays of today. Looking back, the Blue Jays of yesterday, they were a big hit from the time that they came here. Brian, you were involved at that beginning time. What was it like? Give us a slice of the atmosphere back then, what it was like when the Blue Jays came, from your perspective.
Well, first of all, the San Francisco Giants appeared to be the team that was coming. I can remember Frank sitting in Paul Godfrey, who was the Metro chairman at the time, today's publishing, or the head of the National Post. But, you know, let me take you back to the 70s. I mean, let me go back before that to the 60s when I was in high school. We used to take transistor radios to school to listen to the World Series. And I'm talking about when I lived in Edmonton, when I lived in Hamilton, all over North America. I mean, the World Series, wow. This was before they went to night games and Bowie Kuhn, the commissioner, stood there in a freezing night in Cincinnati with a white raincoat on, with a ski jacket on. But baseball was huge, and it was something, you know, in this country, we're always looking for approval from the United States. And, you know, we live next to the most powerful country in the world. But, you know, baseball has been in our blood as much as it's been in the Americans. I mean, the movie 42's out. Jackie Robinson played his first professional baseball with the Montreal Royals. I can remember as a boy in Western Canada, we called it hardball or softball, not baseball.
Mm-hmm.
Baseball, what you say is baseball today was known as hardball. But it was huge. Tom Seaver, the great Mets pitcher, John Cerruti, they all played in places like Medicine Hat, Wetaswan, Alberta. There were great summer leagues out there. So, you know, hockey's our sport, but baseball has been very much a part of this country for decade after decade. So, you know, there was a romanticism when we looked south to see the Boston Red Sox, Cleveland, Kansas City, the Giants, the Dodgers, you know, you go down the list, name the St. Louis Cardinals, the New York Yankees, the Mets, the Phillies, and so on. So now, wow, baseball was going to come to Toronto. Remember, Toronto had quite a baseball history.
Absolutely.
In Triple A, I talked about the Montreal Royals. Sparky Anderson managed here. Many of the Red Sox players played here with the old Toronto Maple Leafs, and they played down at the field on the lakeshore where Tip Top Taylor's eventually was. But so Toronto had a baseball tradition. So now the rumor is the San Francisco Giants are in trouble. They're going to be purchased and brought to Toronto. That didn't happen. Then the expansion. One of the people pushing for Toronto in expansion was Ewing Kaufman, the owner at the time of the Kansas City Royals, a very prominent, very wealthy businessman married to a woman from Toronto. So Ewing Kaufman was one of those that pushed baseball for Toronto. But listen, the team is awarded. I can remember the contest to name the team. I can remember opening day. You know, I'm Ann Murray's a good friend. In fact, I'm emceeing her golf tournament for her, and Ann sang the national anthem. I can remember it was snowing. Bill Singer was a starting pitcher for Toronto. Doug Ault had the home runs, but the game was delayed a bit because of the snow and the cold. So I can remember sitting with Ann in the dugout and talking to her as she prepared for the national anthem. I was covering it locally for CBC. The great Don Chevrier was doing play-by-play. Tony Kubek was not on board then. I believe it was Whitey Ford who was doing the color. Tom McKee was hosting. But here's the great question. Do you know who the public announcer, or public address announcer, was for that first game? Bob McCowan.
Was it Bob McCowan?
Bob, the Bobcat from the Fan 590 in Toronto, was there on opening day, as I was. And, you know, you go back, so many great stories from the old Exhibition Stadium, Dave Winfield and the Seagulls. And remember, this was a stadium that, on a regular basis, drew 55,000 for the Toronto Argonauts. They were huge.
Absolutely.
In those days. And then the move up to Sky Dome. I actually hosted the opening of Sky Dome for CBC. It was on a Sunday night. They opened the roof and it started raining. I can remember.
And
David
I was there. I was there for that. And it leaked inside. there were various sections that water leaked inside. It was funny. It was a great experience. You're right, Brian. The team's done well, and you talk about the history of baseball here in Toronto, and it does have a very, you know, the Dodgers, the Yankees, they had their footprint here in Canada indirectly. The Yankees, broadcasting-wise, because they went into Buffalo, they came here. A lot of us grew up watching the Yankees. For those of us like myself that lived here in southern Ontario, we became Yankee fans. They were the local team, if you will. So, yeah, baseball had a very, and you're right about the hardball. When I was playing softball, we had at that time softball, fastball, hardball. And it depended which one you wanted to play. And I'll let you folks out there figure out which is which. One of the things I wanted to touch as well is Canada is a country that almost we think of Canadians as, you know, hockey players. But we have really, really transcended that, not only in the Olympics, even though as a country and numerically speaking, medals-wise, we haven't dominated like some countries. We still have our athletes that have really stood out. In the Olympics, you had the good fortune of covering many an Olympic. Why don't you share with us some of the greatest athletes, you know, from Nancy to some of the ones that just this past Olympics. We've had some great athletes, haven't we?
We have. By the way, before leaving baseball, when I was a boy, I went to grade 6 and 7 in New Haven, Connecticut. My dad was born in Winnipeg. My dad is still alive. He's a 97-year-old retired doctor, but he went back to study medical administration at Yale University, and he used to take me up to Fenway Park. I saw Ted Williams play. The outfield I remember was Ted Williams in left, the great Jimmy Pearsall, Fear Strikes Out, who had his problems, mental problems at times, and the great Jackie Jensen played in right. But you talk about the Olympics, you've got to separate winter and summer. I mean,
absolutely.
Canada set a record in Vancouver for the most gold medals in the history of the Winter Olympics. Not the most gold medals, Frank, for a host country, but the most gold medals, period. We are a winter sports nation, and Canada, no matter how many, you know, you can go back when they were only winning 7 or 8 medals in some of the Winter Olympics, still was competitive, always has been competitive, in the glamour events. The glamour events of the Winter Games being, for this country, hockey, certainly figure skating for Canada and the United States. Alpine skiing is the glamour event in Europe. But, you know, those are the big events, speed skating now. Canada is competitive. It's a very different story in the Summer Games. You know, if you have a son or a daughter, I don't care what sport in the winter it is. It can be bobsleigh, it can be luge, it can be skeleton. Calgary has some of the best facilities. They are the legacy of 1988 in the Winter Games in Calgary. But the greatest bobsleigh starting facility is in Calgary. The Americans come up and use it. So if your son or daughter wants to be a hockey player, they stay in Canada. They go down the street. They want to be an alpine skier, they stay in Canada. They want to be a speed skater, they stay in Canada. Very different in the Summer Olympics. You want to be a basketball star, you pretty well have to go to an American university. You want to be a track star, Donovan Bailey went down to the University of Texas. And I can go on and on and on. So although Canada doesn't dominate or doesn't compete necessarily in the glamour events in the summer, I give full credit to the summer athletes who for years I think have been thrown under the bus at the expense of the winter athletes. That is changing now. It changed when Alex Bauman came back. He's now departed for New Zealand, but owned the podium, the program that funneled money into research and support for the winter athletes in Vancouver, is now going to the summer athletes. You didn't really see a big change in London. You will see a change in 2016 in Rio de Janeiro. But, you know, let me put the summer and winter into perspective. This soccer team, coached by John Herdman, and led by Christine Sinclair, the wonderful Melissa Tancredi from Hamilton, the bronze medal is the first team, I mean, think about this here, listener. This is the first team medal for Canada at a Summer Olympics since the men's basketball team won a silver in 1936 in Berlin. They lost to the United States in the final. It was something like 16-12, and the reason it was so low scoring, it was played outdoors on a converted tennis court in the rain. So, yes, Canada does so very well at the Winter Olympics, in particular of late. I mean, they, even though we're a winter sports nation, Canada hasn't always done that well at the Winter Games, but certainly competitive in the glamour sports, not necessarily so or not so in the Summer Games. I mean, the glamour events, the sprints, Percy Williams from Vancouver won gold in the 100 and 200 in 1928 in Amsterdam. That's the first time women competed in track and field. Ethel Gathergold won the high jump, the Saskatoon Lily out of Saskatchewan. Bobby Rosenfeld and the sprinters from Toronto did so well. But, the only gold medal in the 100 was by Percy Williams. The late Harry Jerome won a bronze in Tokyo in 64. Ben Johnson won a bronze in L.A. in 84. Then Ben won and lost the medal in Seoul, and Donovan won it and kept it in Atlanta. That's why the performance by this young 4x100 team in London that was given awarded the bronze medal and 10 minutes later disqualified for stepping on a line. I mean, that's absolutely ridiculous. Not that they were disqualified. They stepped on the line. But if you're having an investigation, you don't say they finished third. You say all the results are in question until the investigation is complete. But the reason it was such a big story is in Atlanta, not only did Donovan win the 100, Canada, Bruni Surin, Robert Esme, Glenroy Gilbert, the group, Donovan, they won the 4x100. That event had been won at every Olympics but one prior to that by the United States. That was a great accomplishment, often overlooked. Well, in London, this young team, coached by Glenroy Gilbert, who, along with Carlton Chambers and the others, was a member in Los Angeles, looks like it's won the bronze, and then they're disqualified when the young runner from Prince Edward Island stepped on the line, and they made no excuses. Boy, they manned up. This country fell in love with them. They're going to be a power in Rio de Janeiro. But the glamour events are few and far between for Canada at the Summer Games. But I'm a great fan, admirer of the summer athletes because of the conditions under which they have to train and develop their sport.
Now the Olympics also afford us an opportunity to basically watch sports that normally we don't watch. I was mentioning to the listeners as part of my introduction that you did a show called Sports Weekend for the CBC, which I found always entertaining, especially because at that time, nowadays I kidded with you off the air that it must have been really difficult for you to do stuff during the day, knowing how much you love to watch sports. As a journalist, as somebody who's studying what's going on, nowadays, does your head explode with all the opportunities to watch television and sports?
No, not really. It's changed. When I did the local sports in the 70s, every Blue Jays game wasn't on. If they were playing in Kansas City, I had to phone NBC and see if the NBC affiliate in Kansas City could feed me up a minute highlight package to run on the late local sports. Now every game, every inning, every period, every basket is on television. So, it's very different when you do a late night sports show. It tends to be more highlight oriented, as that's what people want to see. But it wasn't that long ago when all the highlights weren't available. So, it's very different. The world is constantly changing. Look at the internet in Vancouver. For the first time, there was CTV, TSN, Rogers, Aboriginal People's Television, but the internet was a big component, another huge component in London, and that is changing. What's interesting is, sports is the ultimate reality show. Trust me on this one. Mm-hmm. Sports is the ultimate reality show. And everyone says, people are going to watch their laptops. That's fine. That happens. But that increased the audience for over-the-air television in Vancouver and London. Sports is the one event people want to get home at night and see on the big screen. They will watch it if they're not, you know, able to get to a big screen, but certainly right now that's not replacing it. But by the way, you talked about the various sports at the Olympics that we don't usually care about. You know, you don't go down to a bar in February in a Saturday afternoon to watch luge. I'm telling you, it just doesn't happen. Or you don't go to watch skeleton, yet when John Montgomery won that gold medal at Whistler in the skeleton and walked through the village with a pitcher of beer, which was so Canadian, everybody in the country was watching. So, you know, the Olympics has a special draw. You have the sports fan. They'll watch. But, I mean, I get boxes of mail. I've done 14 Olympics going back to 1976. You know, I hear from men, from women, from young, from old, from east, from west, from north, from south, that say to me, we don't normally watch sports, but we've been glued to you. You've been a guest in our living room for 8 or 10 hours a day for the past 16 days. So, you know, you have to explain what these sports are. But as I say, and being a country of, you know, 34 million, compared to 300 million in the United States, Canada tends, and the media tends, we in the media tend to focus, obviously, on the events where there is a medal, and those events aren't always the glamour events. So, you know, the skeleton was a big deal in this country, as was the bobsleigh, as was wrestling, you know, as was the bronze medal in soccer. I think I've talked to people, Frank, men, that say, I don't watch soccer, let alone women's soccer, and I was absolutely mesmerized by this. So, you know, it's the Olympics is unusual and very different from other events.
Now, one thing that can't be denied is, at the very least, whether it sticks or whether the interest remains for the viewers in Canada, one thing's for sure, you did develop some instant stars. You know, there were stars that developed instantly that the Canadian fan, you know, gravitated to. You know, if a skier won and won in a grand fashion, and they were typically Canadian, if you will, many of the Canadian athletes are very, you know, they're not like what we usually see American athletes who, it doesn't matter what event it is, they go crazy winning. The Canadians are, you just see that genuine pride. You must have been very proud to be that close to that many athletes that had so much success in Vancouver.
Yeah, you mentioned the United States. Finally, Canada is becoming more like the United States. We're no longer apologizing for winning. We're not afraid to beat our chests. We're becoming like the Australians and the Americans. I mean, I've had top American athletes that have trained in Calgary that would say to me, Why aren't Canadians, you know, why don't you speak out and speak with more pride and patriotism? Well, Vancouver changed our country. You know, I would walk through the streets of Vancouver at night. Well, I couldn't really walk. People were mobbing me, but, you know, just simply because they watched the Olympics and wanted to talk, they were all very kind. But I would see every color, every race, all kinds of religion, you know, black faces, white faces, red faces, yellow faces, all screaming or wearing something that said proud to be Canadian. And finally we were standing up and saying, hey, you know what? We're pretty darn good. Canada won the most gold medals. And when I say we, I'm talking about the country, and the people are saying we're very proud of that. And I see that newfound confidence beyond sport. Our banking system is the envy of the world through the recession. So this country has changed. I remember talking with Prime Minister Harper. He was in the studio the last Saturday night of the games, and I said, Prime Minister, there's something happening in this country that I've never seen before. And he said, the pride and the patriotism, Frank, was always there. It was just below the surface and needed something to bring it up. And the Vancouver Olympics certainly did that. But let me just say something about the United States, too. You know, the Americans, when you dominate and win as many medals as they do, it's easy to focus only on your athletes. I mean, we do show the bigger picture, but in Vancouver, Canada, you know, was Canadian television was certainly focusing in newspapers and radio on our Canadian athletes because they were doing so well. But I take nothing away from the United States. I applaud them for their patriotism, and finally, we're seeing patriotism and people not afraid to show it in this country.
And we've had athletes that have earned that faith, going back to Weir when he won the U.S. Open. Give me some of your recollections of that moment, because not in our lifetime, at least, Brian, did we see anything that monumental. I mean, winning the U.S. Open in the U.S., of course, in a young Canadian, well, relatively young, a smallish kind of guy, takes on all comers and wins.
Well, we have seen it. We've seen it in winning the Indianapolis 500. We've seen it when Larry Walker was the most valuable player in baseball. Before talking about Mike Weir, you know, you go back to the 70s when the Crazy Canucks were dominating skiing.
Mm-hmm.
In those days, Canadians were not winning, Canadian teams were not winning World Series. Canadian baseball players were not the best in the game. Canadian racing drivers were not winning arguably one of the biggest sporting events in the world. It attracts 500,000 people, that being the Indianapolis 500. Canadians were not winning the Masters golf title. George Knudsen, the late George Knudsen, winner on the PGA Tour in Tucson and Phoenix, very nearly won the Masters. George was a dear friend of mine. I used to see him at the gym, used to sit and talk with him in the steam room, and you know, George always talked about the day a Canadian would win the Masters. I happened to be sitting in the rec room at home here on that Sunday night, and I had tears in my eyes when Mike Weir won, because it was indeed a great moment for this country. But I had the same feeling when Canada took the Indy 500. I had the same feeling when, in fact, I'm sitting in my office looking at a picture of myself standing with Jacques Villeneuve when he won the World Driving, the Formula One. You know, Canada's has really stepped up in areas where we didn't in the past.
Let's talk about, you're touching on the fans, Canadian fans, and have we become more understanding of what it takes to win in sports because of what you're suggesting, that maybe here in Canada we're satisfied to take part? Have you seen a change in the way the fans react? You've had a good opportunity to spend a lot of time in a lot of different cities.
Well, of course. You know, there's a difference, I think. And when I say we, I'm not talking about myself and teams. I'm talking we as Canadian citizens. You know, I always separate professional and quote-unquote amateur. I'm not sure there's such a thing as a true amateur today. There probably is in skeleton or luge, but certainly not in track and field, figure skating, or skiing, even at the Olympics. But, you know, with the pros, you know, when they're paid millions and millions of dollars, you know, they're fair game if they're not coming through. Very different when you're dealing, say, with an 18-year-old young woman or young man who has, in wrestling or something, is not making any money and has sacrificed everything in their life to get to the Olympics. I think Canadians understand the difference. But I think Canadians have always understood what it takes to win. And I think finally we're understanding why maybe Canadians have not won in the past. The support has not been there from the private sector like it was with Own the Podium. But that's changing. I think Canadians are appreciative of the efforts. But listen, if you live in Toronto, you know, the Maple Leafs are still
Brian,
sold out.
You're jumping ahead. Don't do that. Yeah. You're getting ahead of me there. No, you know what? Yeah, you're right. And of course, Canadians are less. Would it be fair to say that the fans are less discriminating in as far as you know being behind sports? Do you think if the fans were more ferocious, do you think maybe you know, companies would be more supportive of our sports?
No, I think I don't think they're less discriminating. I disagree with you. The reason companies have not supported amateur sport is that North America, in particular Canada, is so dominated by professional sport. you know, you can't force the media to cover a university football game if the students don't care to go, and they're drawing, you know, 1,000 between York and the University of Toronto. The Canadian fan is discriminating. They're knowledgeable. They're certainly knowledgeable in hockey, certainly knowledgeable in baseball. Basketball is changing. You look at the multicultural makeup of Toronto and look at the world. Soccer is the number one sport in the world. Basketball is the number two team sport, and whatever's number three is miles below those two. Basketball is huge in South America. Argentina's won a gold medal. You know, it's pretty big in Mexico, huge in the United States. Growing in this country. I mean, look at the high schools. Basketball's big in the high schools, and more Canadians taking a prominent role in the NCAA. Go over to Russia, what was the Soviet Union. Russia basketball's always been popular, but also some of the other countries that made up the Soviet Union, Lithuania, Latvia, the Ukraine, go down to Israel and then go around the Mediterranean through Greece, through what used to be Yugoslavia, going to Croatia now, Bosnia-Herzegovina, France, Italy, Spain. Basketball is huge, and now basketball is huge in particular in Toronto. These fans are knowledgeable, and they support the team, even though it's been a major disappointment. So I would disagree if you say Canadian fans are less discriminating. I think they're very discriminating, and I think they, if that's proper use of the English, they're knowledgeable. In particular, at the Olympics, we're a country that looks outward. When you go to school in this country, you learn more than just Canada. I hear the United States criticized. Heck, forget people in Georgia. We say they don't know anything about Canada when Atlanta was playing the Blue Jays. They don't know anything about New York City, some of them. It's a very sort of and I'm not being a smart aleck. Their thinking tends to be insular. Canadian fans have a great appreciation for the Olympics, and Canadian sport fans have an appreciation for athletes from other countries, whether it be Britain, Kenya, the Middle East, China, South America. So, no, Canadian sports fans are discriminating. They are very knowledgeable. They understand, and they're loyal.
We've had more than one MVP in Canada from Major League Baseball. Right now, the highest-rated high school-age player in the United States is Canadian.
That's in basketball.
Yeah, that's what I'm referring to. We have a good showing in hockey because that leads the way. And as far as Canadian greatness, curling, we're one of the tops in that as well. While we may not have the depth in basketball or of course. Baseball, I'm inclined to agree with you. Now, speaking as within the country, I've noticed that Vancouver, BC, naming towns like Maple Ridge, baseball has produced, Vancouver, the area in BC, has produced a lot of great baseball players. Joey Votto is an unusual player from the Toronto area. We haven't really had that many. I tend to suggest that BC has produced many better baseball players than the Ontario area. Why is that?
I'm not sure. Joey Votto being from Islington, Larry Walker's from Maple Ridge, Justin Morneau from the Minnesota Twins, British Columbia. I'm also looking at a picture in my office of the late Greg Moore standing with myself. It was killed, the great IndyCar driver was killed in a race in California. Greg was from Maple Ridge. Cam Neely, Don Cherry's favorite player with the Boston Bruins, also from Maple Ridge, B.C. I don't know why. Baseball is big in Southern Ontario. It's big in British Columbia. I don't have the answer for that. I'll tell you where baseball was absolutely huge, and that's you go back into Quebec. I talked about Jackie Robinson and the old Montreal Royals. Baseball all through, up through Three Rivers, the Saguenay. Baseball was huge. The Expos were huge. Listen, I'm old enough to remember when the Expos came to this country in the late 60s and how Montreal had a hold on this country. Le Grand Orange, Rusty Staub. And listen, the Expos with Ellis Valentine, Warren Cromartie, that team would have probably won the World Series.
Monday.
Well, no, this is after Rick Monday. This is the next year when baseball was shut down in the middle of the season. Rick Monday was the Dodgers that beat them in the playoffs. But I'm moving ahead to the year baseball was shut down. Montreal was in first place ahead of Atlanta. They were averaging 45 or 50,000 a game. That killed baseball in Montreal. That and the fact they didn't build a stadium downtown. Had they built a small stadium downtown, I think baseball would still be in Montreal. But baseball has a great tradition in this country.
Well, it's ironic, really, because you're right about that. I was just my biggest expo moment was when Monday, basically on his own that afternoon, beat the Expos. I watched and it broke my heart. Ironically, the Toronto Blue Jays, you talk about 40,000 people watching the Expos up until the lockout. The next year, the Blue Jays, lost a few players, gave up on a few players, and also it was the end of the big crowds here for Toronto. I guess maybe you're right. I mean, Toronto fans and Canadian fans are, they're quite intelligent, and they make decisions based on how they feel they're treated. And we lost the Expos, and the Jays have suffered. Let's talk about Toronto, and I'd like to get on to, we've got a few minutes left here to talk about the CFL. You have been central in the CFL. You've had the good fortune, again, always there at the important events, the Grey Cup. Give us a summation of some of the great Cups you've seen in your time as a broadcaster, as a journalist.
Well, as a fan, before I do broadcasting, I can remember when the Grey Cup was played on Saturday. I can remember the Winnipeg Hamilton Fog Bowl. It started on a Saturday and was finished on a Sunday, that was the year that NBC decided to carry the Grey Cup live, and the great Kurt Gowdy was doing the play-by-play.
Mm-hmm.
And Kurt Gowdy preceded, of course, people like Dick Enberg and Al Michaels. But Kurt was doing play-by-play, and the game was called by fog on the Saturday and completed on Sunday, Winnipeg-Hamilton. So I can remember as a boy going to playoff games when we lived in Edmonton to see Jackie Parker for the Eskimos against Kenny Plain of the Bombers. And, it was below zero Fahrenheit, and we were in sleeping bags. It was so darn cold. But, I've covered, I think, 36, 37 Grey Cups. There are so many. I remember being in Regina the Baltimore won one of its Grey Cups, or won the only Grey Cup by an American team. That game was played in Regina. I can remember we wondered if about 20 minutes to air, the wind was so strong, the temporary seats at the north end of Taylor Field were shaking, and the wind had to be below a certain speed, official speed, from the weather center at the airport, or they weren't going to open the stadium to the fans, and it did drop down. I can remember being in Montreal, something I will never, ever forget, interviewing then Prime Minister Trudeau and his three sons. One of the young men, of course, later drowned in British Columbia. Justin's now leading the Liberal Party, but I it's something you always look back on. That's the game that the Ottawa Rough Riders were supposed to lose by 100 points to the Edmonton Eskimos, and Tony Gabriel made that great catch limping in the
awesome
first half. Ottawa did lose the game, but they played a great game. There's just so many great moments. I remember the first game in BC Place. I can remember going back to BC after the Olympics when it was remodeled, and the first game in a remodeled BC Place. I've done Grey Cups in Calgary. I've done all the Grey Cups in Edmonton. I've done the Grey Cups in Regina. I'll be back in Regina this year. Winnipeg, I remember 1991. John Candy, Wayne Gretzky, and Bruce McNall owned the team. And I'll never forget Martin Short. I went to Westdale High School in Hamilton, and so did Martin Short, and I know Marty. And he came up with his son Oliver. I remember standing on the sidelines, and Marty said, "Hey, this movie star, Martin Short." He says, I need a favor." I said, "What's the favor?" He said, "I need Ron Lancaster's autograph." He grew up a great CFL fan. But we did the 20th anniversary documentary on that team, and it included Rocket Ishmael. Someone actually threw a can of beer at him when he was returning a punt or a kick. Matt Dunnigan was the quarterback as they defeated the Calgary Stampeders. I'm looking at a party picture here in my office of myself holding the game ball with Marty Short and Wayne Gretzky. at the party. I remember so many great CFL games. Montreal, I did the Grey Cups in Ottawa too. I remember 1988 after coming home from the Seoul Olympics. It was a beautiful sunny day, probably maybe plus 15, certainly plus 12 or 13, Winnipeg and the BC Lions. That's when Winnipeg had moved into the East. I remember doing, I remember Jim Hunt saying in the days when, is the league going to go bankrupt or is it going to go out of business? I'd do the pregame show. We wouldn't talk football. We'd talk which teams were not going to be here the next year. And I remember Jim Hunt, he had that high-pitched voice saying, they should only play the Grey Cup and the hell with the season, the regular season. But, I think Mark Cohan has done a magnificent job. This league is stronger than it's ever been. You go to the West, Vancouver, with that spectacular renovated BC place. Edmonton, Dick Enberg used to say, he and the late Merlin Olsen did during the NFL shutdown.
Lockup,
they
came
up and they did a CFL game. Loved Commonwealth Stadium. It's they've redone the locker rooms. Calgary's still a good stadium. Regina is going to get a new stadium. Winnipeg Stadium will open, I believe it's June 27th. That's Montreal, Winnipeg. I'll be doing that game. That'll seat 42,000 on the campus of the University of Manitoba. Hamilton will play in Guelph this year at the University of Guelph, but they will have a new stadium, and I think it's appropriate. It's still going to be on the site of the old Ivor Wynne, which used to be known as Civic Stadium, but instead of facing east-west, it will face north and south, so you don't get the sun in your eyes and in the evenings in the summertime. Montreal has just added seats. Toronto, the problem's not the stadium, it's the way the game's been promoted, but they're on the right track. Ottawa's interesting, the nutty Gliebermans, crazy horns,
with
wacky owners, but they've got good ownership now. And I'm going to tell you, the Greenberg family, very prominent in Ottawa, Jeff Hunt, who runs the Ottawa 67s, when the Senators came in, the 67s were supposed to go out of business. They're one of the most successful minor hockey league franchises in North America. So you've got good people. Ottawa will be a success. So, the league's doing well. I remember my friend Brent Musper, when he was on a phone show. He was also on with Don Cherry and myself when we had our phone show. In addition to our daily radio show, but Musburger, somebody was criticizing the CFL, and Brent said he was hosting at the time the NFL Today on CBS, the forerunner of Fox and NBC's pregame shows. He said, this is a league with, at the time, 75, 80 years history. The only people that run down the CFL are Canadians, not Americans, and they used to try and compare it to the NFL. It's a different game. You can't win comparing it to the NFL. You sell it for what it is, a good, exciting game with a wonderful history and, I believe, a strong future.
Now, you mentioned you hit on a couple of salient points. There seems to be a trend, or at least there must be. If a bad thing's a red flag, what color's a good flag? A green flag's around, if you will. Montreal, associated with the local college team. Winnipeg, associated with the local college team. Is this something that maybe Canadian teams should consider more? And specifically here in Toronto next year, as a season ticket holder, I'll be sitting in Varsity Stadium watching the Alouettes play the Argonauts. Do you see a viability for... Yeah.
The Alouettes are playing the Argonauts at Varsity?
Yes, sir. Preseason game.
Oh, yeah. I thought you meant a regular season. Yeah.
Yeah, preseason. I apologize for misleading you. Do you think a lot will hang in the balance of how that's received by the fans? For the Argos making an overall decision?
The Argos
it's out there.
Yeah, the Argos have to play at SkyDome right now, but Paul Beeston has made no secret of the fact that the Blue Jays want natural grass. So they're one of the few teams with artificial turf, and a lot of players don't want to come to Toronto because of the artificial turf. It's hard on the legs. I believe Varsity Stadium could have been redone with 25, maybe double decked for 35,000-40,000. That didn't happen. One of the great successes in Montreal is when they moved from the Big O to McGill, it's near Crescent Street, which is sort of the Yorkville of Montreal, or Yorkville's the Crescent Street of Toronto, however you want to put it. And, people on a Saturday night go out of the game, they go into the fine restaurants. I think it would have been great to play at Varsity. That's not going to happen. I don't think York University is the answer. It's too far out. It would have been great if the soccer stadium could be redone for football, but that was not to be at Exhibition Place. So I don't know what the answer is. I think the answer is probably a smaller stadium, one about 35,000-40,000. I'm not sure where they'll build it, but you know, the Argonauts have their problems. It's more than just winning. The Grey Cup was a great success. TSN gets big, big audiences, outdrawing the Blue Jays in the summer, so you don't get a big audience without Southern Ontario. So the fans are here. I don't know what the answer is to get them back, but I do salute David Brayley. You know, David Brayley didn't try to buy two teams. He bought the Argonauts because no one else wanted it, and you know, David Brayley takes a lot of criticism, but he saved football in British Columbia when nobody out there wanted to buy the Lions, and now they're a huge success. I can see him probably selling the Lions in the next couple of years. He'll probably hang on to the Argonauts, but, you know, people say, well, he owns 25% of the league. Yeah, I know it's not a great thing, but he didn't come and say, I want to own two teams. He got the second team because no one wanted the Argonauts.
Yeah, and they've basically... I guess they've maintained its existence, if you will.
That's exactly what they've done. Very good point.
And until they make headway with the fans and figure out what it'll take, and as you said, the people have to want to come as part of a complete evening, and it doesn't all have to happen at the game, but it would be helpful if it was in an easily accessible place. A comfortable stadium, and my contention is, as a season ticket holder with the Toronto Argonauts, my biggest complaint would be sitting in a stadium that's half full is very disconcerting. It takes away from the, like football more than any other sport, really relies on the fans getting in the mood, if you will. And it really is hard to get in the mood when you have a lot of empty seats.
Well, the late Harold Ballard once told me, 10,000 looks better in a 10,000 arena than 15 does in a 20. And you're absolutely right when you see empty seats. Hey, listen, people say the NFL is an experience. One of my daughters who's in sports marketing, remember the first time she went to an NFL game, I said, so how was the game? Oh, Dad, you should have seen the pregame tailgating. Well, how was the game? Dad, you should have seen the halftime show. I mean, it's an experience. And, you know, it's not a good experience when you're sitting in a stadium and there are a lot of empty seats. But when you watch that stadium at the Grey Cup,
oh my God! I was there.
Every camera shot shows a full stadium. It is you know, it's a different message. And when you sit home and watch the television, and you know, you can't ignore the empty seats, it sends out a bad message. But I believe slowly they're on the right track in Toronto, but they still got a long way to go.
By the way, Jan Krinchy said to say hello to you.
I remember Jan Krinchy when he played with the Argonauts when they won their first Grey Cup in 1983. In Vancouver, beating the BC Lions, the first Grey Cup since 1952. And back in those days, the Argonauts were drawing 50,000-55,000 a game. Leon McCoy, well, I remember when they lost the fumble to Calgary, Joe Theismann quarterbacking, but I remember that team. Joe Barnes was one of the quarterbacks that won in 1983. Jan Kerensky was on that team, and they beat the BC Lions.
Yeah, he wanted to say hello, so I said, I'll say hello to Brian.
He was a class act when he played, and an example of a Canadian player. Listen, I know the Americans make a difference in this league, but you don't win in the CFL without good Canadians.
Absolutely not, and I think that was the strength that the Argos had this year, which led to their ability to actually win. Talking about football here in Toronto, we've discussed the fact that you know, Toronto needs a better participation or a more suitable stadium, a better environment for the game to be played. It's hard to have tailgate parties here in Toronto because of, you know, the tight drinking laws that are in existence, you know, and there's no grandfathering. In Hamilton, they're building a new stadium, as you said, and tailgating is going to become very difficult. In fact, there's talk that they'll be busing people from where they can tailgate to the game, which I think is going to take away from the tailgating experience. Now, they have all new stadiums. The teams, the talent, we know there's a lot of great Canadian football players. You had the good fortune of being at the Grey Cup this year. Give us some ideas about these stadiums a little more. So by your definition, and you know, being a journalist and what you've said, it sounds to me like, other than the Argos, the teams are all set as far as stadiums are concerned. Do you think that that'll put a little more pressure on the league to help somehow? Because Toronto is required, as you said, you can't get great ratings if Toronto isn't taking a part. How do you don't see a way that a stadium can be built here, maybe in cooperation between the CFL and Toronto in some capacity? I mean, you know all the important people.
Yeah, it's going to be tough to get taxpayer dollars, but there's enough money in the city to get it done. I mean, if I had the answer, Frank, I'd be running the CFL. I think Mark Cohan has his finger on the pulse. He's well connected. He's done a good job. He understands business. I don't think you'll see one soon, but they better get moving, because I do know the Blue Jays want natural turf in the Rogers Center, and that will mean no football team, because a football team tears it up. And then, of course, the baseball team has to pay the main tenant, mainly because, you know, they have 81 home games compared to, 8 or 9 for football. You know, they're not going to want to play in a field that's been torn up. So something has to be done. I don't have the answer, but I think we will see the answer come out within the next year.
And it is a decision that there has to be a plan in place by the end of this year, or it could be difficult then for them to continue.
No, I agree with you 100%.
Okay, so now here's the CFL. We have a lot of great players that play the Canadian game. And the Argos win the Grey Cup, and instead of Mr. Cohan, Mr. Brian Williams hands out the trophy. How the heck did that happen? You know, usually
I didn't hand it out. The commissioner handed it out. I was. They did something different this year, and I give both TSN and the league a lot of credit. They came to me, the commissioner, back in October, and said, "Look, we'd like you to be part of the halftime show." And I said, "Look, I'm not introducing Marianas Trench and Gordon Lightfoot, who happens to be a good friend of mine, Justin Bieber, whom I, you know, is a great star, but that's just not me. I'm a journalist." And so we talked, and TSN came up with the fact that, you know, I would do the pregame show, then I would go and interview the prime minister, and then I would quickly get into the stands and introduce Johnny Reid, the big country star, and introduce the national anthem. Then at halftime, I would be in the stands, and, you know, Paul Harrington wrote it, a beautiful script, but I had no autocue or anything. I had it all in my head about this being a country of great distances and the icons like the railway shrinking the distances, and introduced Gordon, and then introduced, I believe, Marianas Trench was next, and Justin Bieber, the young lady that just won the Junos from British Columbia, saying, and then Justin Bieber was the last one. Let me say something, and I agree with Don Cherry on this. Whether or not you like Justin Bieber, as Canadians, I couldn't believe that some idiots actually booed him. This young man, at the time, and still is, arguably one of, if not the biggest musical acts in the world. So give the CFL credit. You know, the Super Bowl gets the Stones, they get Bruce Springsteen. You know, this is the 100th anniversary. The CFL went out and got an icon in Gordon Lightfoot, who is known all over North America. Carly Rae, the young woman that won at the Junos in Regina on Sunday night, sang. Marianas Trench, also Juno winners, performed out of Vancouver, good band. And Justin Bieber, and as Cherry said, only Canadians would boo him. Don said, "Look, I don't even know the young guy. I'm not a particular fan, but I do know he's the best in the world at what he does. And damn it, as Canadians, we should stand up and appreciate that."
And they didn't. On that note, a proud Canadian, a journalist, a man who has seen so much action around the world. Brian, I really appreciate you taking the time to come and talk to me. It's been about 20-some-odd years since I had you in the studio. My wife says to say hello. You're a very nice man, and you don't like being told, but I remember you asking me, you said to me, you really care about what's going on out there, and you said to me, "Who's that guy on your show, Frank? You got that guy there, he's like this and like that." I think you said he was tall. I said, "He's Claude Fague, and he's on the sidelines while you're in the booth." So we've gone full circle, And I really thank you for the years that you've given to sports and how you've helped me to understand what I'm seeing on the screen. Your dedication to sports is appreciated. And I'm sure all the fans out there of sports and of Brian Williams are glad you could be on and we could have a chance to listen to you. Thank you, sir.
Well, listen, it's been a thrill. And, you know, as I tell the other Brian Williams, the young, good-looking one making $10 million a year in New York doing nightly news, we've become friends and gotten to know each other. He always says to me, you can't stop doing the Olympics. But what I've tried to do is to put myself in the seat of the viewer or the listener if it's radio and ask the questions they would. The fans are not stupid. If the game's a blowout, say it's a blowout. And take a stand, you know, as I did in London when they refused to recognize the Israeli athletes. That's disgraceful on the 40th anniversary of the slaughter. You know, it's not a happy moment. It's a significant moment. I would have been just as outspoken had they been from any other country, Arab or India, wherever. It happened to be Israel, and not recognizing them was wrong. And I said it, and I said it in very forceful terms. And for the president of the IOC to say they're not doing it because it's political, as I said on the air, duh, come on, political. And when you march behind flags and sing national anthems, the event is political by its very nature. And they did honor the loser in Vancouver from Georgia that died the day of the opening ceremonies. And they should have, but they also should have recognized and saluted the great Israeli coaches and athletes. So I've just tried to be honest, Frank. As I say, I give the viewer credit. They're smart, and you know, don't insult them by sugarcoating something or BSing them.
Thanks for joining us today, Brian.
Okay, no, I wonder if you're still there. Oh, listen,
no,
I thought my where's my pizza?
I'll be delivering it soon, so you want me to deliver it to KNY Productions, right?
All right, no. As I say, I'm sitting here, and I was waiting, and I was starting to fall asleep, and when you phoned me, you went, hi, is it a pizza man? I said, yeah, right. And then I realized we're on the air, so anyhow,
yeah.
It's been a pleasure, my friend.
It was really good talking to you again. Brian, all my best, and I hope your family keeps growing. I have four daughters. You have three daughters. You sympathize with our situation.
There's nothing to sympathize with. It's everything to envy. Be well.
But you too. Bye.
Take care.
Okay, that's Brian Williams. We'll take a short break right now. We're going to come back. Are you ready for this? I'm going to bring back an interview that we did a little while ago, and it's with Dan Ferrone. I just felt like doing it because, you know, Jan Karinci, 1983 Grey Cup, this was his buddy.
The following is a message from the 2012 Grey Cup champions, your Toronto Argonauts. If you didn't hear your voice, there's still time to be a part of next year's crowd. It's okay to pile on. Get your 2013 season tickets today. Call 416-341-ARGO or go to argonauts.ca. Argo!
Well, due to the problems we're having with our technical side here, I'm going to have to do a different interview. Let's do part one of Jan Karinci, for those of you that listened to it earlier. Well, you can listen to it again. Just listen more carefully this time.
Alone. So there was one Grey Cup victory with the Argonauts, 1983, 30th year anniversary coming up this year. Selfless plug, there will be a celebration at the Calgary game, August the 23rd. And probably all of your old-time favorites from the 83 team, Connor Holloway, Carl Brazley, Terry Greer, Dan Ferrone, and even me making the trip from Mauritius, which, as you said, southwestern Indian Ocean, 8,000 miles from Moncton, which is the last place I live in Canada, all the way back to Toronto.
And I remember a story you told me about taking out the golf clubs for the first time in Mauritius. Tell the folks about that.
That was hilarious. I've got an iPhone, and on the iPhone I've got a GPS golf app that tells me how far it is away I am from, you know, whatever hole I happen to be on at whatever golf course I'm playing. And I had always had it set up to be on the golf course that I was playing in New Brunswick in Moncton, which was Royal Oaks. And I guess I hadn't turned it off the last time I used it, because when I turned it on here, it immediately took me to the Royal Oaks map. And it said, you are 8,332 miles away from the pin on the seventh hole of Royal Oaks. Now, what would have been fun about it is when it said at the bottom, we suggest you use driver. But you kind of get the gist of the story.
Now, that is funny. And you did mention that you lived in Moncton, New Brunswick. You've been a person who's traveled. I mentioned earlier that you were born in London, England. You came to Toronto, right? Your family came to Toronto, and that's where you picked up the football bug?
Yeah, we came to Toronto when I was six, okay? And it wasn't the football bug that I picked up, rather the hockey bug, because this was 1966. And those of you old enough as you and I are, Frank, will remember that in 1966-67, what happened?
The Leafs won the Cup.
Exactly. So I became a huge Leaf fan, you know, back in the glory days of the original six, and just was all set to you know, later, you know, after that summer, to play hockey at the age of nine. And right, I think it was the middle of August or maybe beginning of September, my neighbor up the street, Larry Aiken, came to me and he said, listen, we play football. Do you want to play football?
As a message from the 2012 Grey Cup champions, your
Toronto
Argonauts.
We have the interview. Here we go. Sorry, Ken.
If you didn't hear your voice, there's still time to be a part of next year's crowd. It's okay to pile on. Get your 2013 season tickets today. Call 416-341-ARGO or go to argonauts.ca. Argo!
Do you want to be heard, disagreed with, or just plain shot down? Come on! Be brave! Call the Candid Frank Live Show, a.k.a. the CFL Show. You already hit the link to bring up the player, and you hit the play button so you can hear us. Now hit that little Skype button on that Candid Live player sitting there, like your pet wanting a snack. So to connect with us and tell us your thoughts, hit that little tiny, cute, and tempting Skype button. Right? Now, do it! Or call 714-242-5250. That's 714-242-5250. Born April 3rd, 1958, in the town of Oakville, before it was a city. Educated at T.A. Blakelock in Oakville. Moved on to Simon Fraser University. Was drafted. Not so much drafted. He was a territorial exemption in 1981. He won four Grey Cups, winning two of them in 83 and 91. Was an offensive lineman for the Toronto Argonauts from 81 to 88 and 90 to 92. And as a member of the Calgary Stampeders in 89, he played 213 games in his career. He was a 10-year Argo captain. eighth all-time Argonaut with 175 career games played. He was an all-Eastern guard during the years of 83 to 87 and 90 to 92, all-Western guard in 89, Argo's offensive line coach in 2002, team president in 2003. In 2006, he was named as an all-time Argo. And in 2007, he was also named to the all-time Argo team list as a guard. 10-time team-nominated outstanding lineman and 2-time league finalist, CFL's All-Star team 5 times, CFL Divisional All-Star 9 times, 1992 to 2000. He was the president of the Canadian Football League Players Association. He was the VP and eventually president of the Toronto Argonauts. In 2004, was inducted into the Oakville Sports Hall of Fame. And now, why is he here? Will be inducted this year in Edmonton to the Canadian Football League Hall of Fame, number 69 on your program, Dan Ferrone. Wow. Let's hope it's him. What do you think? I'm going to guess that it's him. You know that? I'm going to guess that it's him. Dan, is that you?
It's me.
It's you,
that
Dan?
That was quite something. Yes.
It's really
who
you?
Who were you talking about there? That guy sounds pretty impressive. Holy crap.
Of course he sounds impressive. Dan, I gotta come clean with you first because I don't wanna trap you on these. There's two things I need to tell you. One, I did. You went to school with my brother-in-law. Now, his name's Fred Austin, but he's a geek, so he really didn't care about sports. So he missed an opportunity to know you back in the day. But we also have a group, as I told you on the telephone, and since I've spoken to you, I've found out. Are you ready for this? I've got your 2 rings on display here. On the show, on our screen, because apparently your son is marrying a very nice lady whose sister is an Argo lifer, and
yes.
Her name is Erica Lemieux.
Absolutely, yes. Well, isn't that a small world? When did you find all that out? That's terrific.
Today, this show is really not about me. It's about the Argos, and it's about CFL football, Canadian football to be specific, okay? So there's a few of us that go to the Argo games, and I don't have to tell you that Toronto is not one of the strongest markets for the Canadian Football League. But what it also means is that when you get involved with people who love the game as much as the Argo lifers love the game, it's catchy. You know what I'm saying? It rubs off on you. And with this group, I met this young lady. She's into gardening. She has a little gardening business. And we talked, and I didn't know that you were that you two were going to end up being related. So I just thought that was really sweet and that was really nice. She's a really nice lady. And the only reason I mention it is because I hope you don't mind. For those who are watching on their computer, can look at our screen and you'll see Dan's 2 gray cup rings. They're impressive, my friend. They're very impressive.
Oh, and my future's daughter-in-law's sister, we at our engagement party, she comes up, she starts telling me about how she is a lifer with the Toronto Argos, and her neighbor got her involved into it. And I went, holy smokes, this is fantastic. You know, it's always there's such good people, and we're so excited about the upcoming marriage and everything like that. So, wow, that's a small world. Good job.
Very small. I thought it was a big deal when I found out that. Yeah, my wife tells me, she always says to me, "Do you ever hear about Dan Ferrone?" Honey, he's retired a long time ago. I don't know what he's doing now. He's probably knitting sweaters or something. I don't know. He's got to be doing something. then I read your bio, and I'm saying to myself, you know, I can't do that bio without doing something with the other 5 guys because there was so much to talk about. You have really – let's start at the beginning. You went to Blakelock in Oakville. It's not a – I don't know. I don't think it's a football-producing program there. It's a small school. in at that time, Oakville wasn't a very large place, right? And so
right.
you started playing football. What? Well, how did you begin in football? Did you begin back then, or did it start a little later for you?
Well, you know, back then, really, the only opportunity you got to play the game of football was in high school. There was no, like, Pop Warner or junior football leagues or anything like that. Really, if you didn't play football in high school, you never got to play. And I was invited to try out in grade 9. I tried out, and I had Vern Lusick as a coach that from that point on became a lifelong mentor for me. He was a sensational and important part of my life growing up. And, like you said, Blakelock was no powerhouse or anything like that. But by the time we left, my final year, we won the Halton Championship. And we played in an era, you know, I got to play against guys like Schultze and Jason Riley, and all these guys were all in different teams throughout Burlington, Priestner, John Priestner. These guys were all in the Halton Football League back then, and a big crop of professional players came out of it.
At that time, as I have family that played football, recreational football was big in the Halton region at that time.
Well, like an intramural and or what you call intramural or street football was hugely popular. On our high school team, we had to recruit to get a big number of players to come. I remember playing against the crosstown rival at the time, Purdue. And their coach there, he was happy to be to have 19 players, and he would play a whole game, a whole season with 19 players, and do very well. Football's been a growing game in Canada. We will always compete with hockey. They have a saying that the CFL is punishment to those Canadian kids that didn't work hard enough at hockey. So it's something that, football has grown over time. And I look at the university level now, and like Mustangs and Waterloo and Western, and I see the fans that come out. They have 6,000-seat stadiums. They have all the, the songs that go with it, the cheers that go with it. It's really been growing, and it's taken a long time. You know, it's not what the level of football recognition is down in the States. But, my time from when I started with Blakelock to, this year being inducted into the Hall of Fame, I've seen a tremendous growth in football in Canada. And I've always, I'm so proud to be a part of it.
Simon Fraser was the university that you went to play football that time. At that time, tell us a little bit about the team and university football at that time.
Yeah, well, Simon Fraser is a very unique school. They were the only Canadian university that played in the United States. I was invited to a lot of schools and was recruited a little bit out of high school. Football program, and was recognized a little bit as being a player. The very unique thing about Simon Fraser that really they came and watched me play basketball, and the football coach goes, "Well, if you could play basketball like that, you should be great at football." So the meaning to me, he never watched me play football, but was told about me. So they flew me out to BC. So here's a little Italian kid that hasn't crossed over Kerr Street in Oakville, to travel anywhere. And I'm invited to go to BC over the weekend, and they do a full recruit job on me. My God, I was so impressed and was so excited about being part of the football program at Simon Fraser. And they were actually a factory of producing professional football players. They had produced more professional football players than any other school in North America other than Grambling University in the States. Almost every CFL roster had two or three Simon Fraser grads on it. So it was a factory, as they called it. We played in the NAIA Division I. We played NCAA Division III teams. We traveled by bus. We stayed in Motel 6s. We had one of the smallest budgets of any of the teams we played. Great stories all in that. But the career with them was, was very enjoyable. It was one of my best times. I have friends there that will be friends for life. And it was a good call that I decided to go to Simon Fraser University and take a place in their football program.
Now, at Simon Fraser, did you ever have an occasion to play or to experience a bowl game?
No, we never went to any bowl games. The uniqueness, so we would play. I laugh. We would play at teams like Nevada. We would play Idaho. We played in the Kibbe Dome, which was a big indoor stadium. These teams were, I'll never forget Reno, Las Vegas, who really at that point in time had some serious ball players, and they played division. They might have been Division I, but a different kind of league. And we had just done our fundraiser, and we were able to raise $25,000, and we had 200 people come to it, and it was a very successful event for us. And we come down to play Reno, and they fly the whole team down. They put us up in the hotel. They give us the per diem. They pay us to come to Reno and be their hometown, their homecoming game. And on the TV, while we're preparing for the next day to go to before going to sleep and preparing for the game the next day, they had a commercial, and they talked about the fundraising event that Reno was having for their football team. Now, it had 2,500 people coming. Their goal was to raise about $250,000.
Holy!
And Frank Sinatra was the guest of the evening for the event. I mean, that was. Like that was night and day. That was the comparison of two, and we played very well against them. We lost maybe by 10, 15 points, that may sound like sour grapes, but the home team at refs always works for them. You know, you'd see a flag go up in the air after we would cross their goal line. It was always something that brought the ball back, but it was that's the kind of the difference. In the Canadian and the American version, it's dollars and cents. They got so much dollars, it's mind-boggling.
It doesn't surprise me to hear that, and it probably has been like that, as you say, going back a long time. I think more important than that, I guess, the experience is always good to play with a better team, a better organization, or against a better team, or against a better organization, because it does lift your ability, right? Dan,
yeah,
you know,
well,
it's
yeah,
always good. It would be nice. I've always been a proponent of it would be nice if there were a few more exhibition games between the universities in Canada and, you know, maybe Division III teams, Division II, you know, in the U.S., they're going to get a wider field, and pretty soon they're going to realize, they will realize, that the way we play the game isn't so bad after all. And you know, we're getting a little bit of exposure. We're not sharing the large crowds that they have. But help us to understand how football, in your opinion, could be better here in Ontario, and specifically in the Southern Ontario, Greater Toronto market, which has so many sports that are competing for players.
Yeah, well, you know, I believe that they do a great job. We have certain circumstances that are true to fact. We could always compete. Our talent and our professionalism and our knowledge of the game, we would always compete with the U.S. colleges. This is where it breaks down. We're such a small population. We are 30 million. They are 300 million. The dollars, like I told you, that's a big component. Where we will have 4 to 5 coaches for a team, they have 10 to 20 coaches for the team. You know, the left tight end has his own coach, and the right tight end has their own coach, along with the offensive line have two coaches. It's just, so they talk about training, and in the Army, the best trained soldiers will be the best Army, and it's in the sport of football. You know, they have 10 types of population, so for every, you know, one really good athletic person here in Canada, they're going to have that 10 guys. But along with the training, along with the dollars and the cents that follow it and chase it and make it grow bigger, that's where the differential is. But, you know, our good players are playing in the NFL, and our great players are big successes there. Lots of Americans have come up here, and they can't cut it, they can't make it. And a lot of them have come up and they've excelled because they were specially made for our type of game. So there is two different types of game, and when you talk about the market in Ontario, it is a tough market. You know, I was in Calgary and Edmonton where, man, those games are sold out, and you're recognized walking down the street because, you know, there's no competition for who the sports athlete. Regina, I used to always envy the Saskatchewan players because they were the kings of the castle, and they still are, sort of thing. And in Toronto, we have competition. You know, we have a lot of different things. You have Broadway, you have hit shows, you have Blue Jays. You know, I love our Argo fight song. You know, the Argo fight song is "Go Leafs, go, and take the Blue Jays with you." It's something that we work hard at. You know, the Argos make every effort to be, you know, they're 140 years old this year, and, you know, they're in the community the most, and nobody will deny it. The Raptors and the Leafs will always say, yes, you know, the Argos do such a great job in the community. They do so much charitable work, and they go speak to schools, and they're everywhere that they're asked to be. And it's a challenge for all the other teams to do the same thing that the Argos do. So we do a lot of great things, and we do it. And, you know, it's about how many people are Toronto fans. And, you know, I know you agree with me, but the Toronto fans are great fans. So the ones we have make up for the ones we don't have.
Well, we're here. Part of this is, you know, this is not to sound like a tag day for the CFL. It's only this program's initiation was brought on by the fact that I truly believe, and with the help of John Granger, you know, we truly believe that football can be a success in Toronto, and it doesn't have to be the NFL. It can be the CFL. I think, you know, the biggest problem that I have is that if people would take the time to show up for the cost, and Dan, this isn't a negative thing. You know, you can buy a season ticket for the same price it costs to go to a Leaf game. You know,
you're absolutely right. Yep.
I don't know how much of a bargain anybody wants in the world to go watch professional athletes who give their all, and they're playing on a Canadian team against other Canadian teams. People ask me why I support the CFL. It's because of Montreal, Toronto, Ottawa, Winnipeg, Calgary, Edmonton, Saskatchewan, BC. That's why I support them. They're all Canadian teams, and why wouldn't you want to support a sport that's Canadian? Now, moving on to your experience, and you reached the upper echelon, the upper experience of being a Canadian Football League player twice. In my opinion, we're about the same age. I'm older than you. I could be your older brother. 1983 was a special year when you won that Grey Cup. You know, it was a culmination of a lot of, you know, tough years for Argo fans, wasn't it?
It was. Well, you know, 1981 is the worst record in Argo history. So in 140 years, nobody had a worse record than 2-16. And take you back to 1981, it's like we're the front page news. We are the opening sports story on TV and on the radio. We're talked about everywhere. It's, you know, like I said, 47,000 fans at CNE Stadium. It's wild, and that's my first year, and we have, for some reason, the worst year ever, and we lose the first three games by 3 points, like 4 points. It's like we were there, but we never got that close ever again, and we started losing 63-7 in Edmonton and 56-12 in Winnipeg. It was horrendous. It was things like, you know, do the Argyle diet, eat when the Argyles win. You know, they had us frying. You know, I remember my parents telling the story. They were getting their 35-year PIN for working at GE, and in the presentation they go, you know, it's too bad your son has to play for the Toronto Argonauts. Jan Krejci's little brother was getting into fights at school, defending the Argonauts. It was something to be a part of. And then the next year we go to the Grey Cup and we have a great season with Obilovich coming along, but we lose the Grey Cup game to the Edmonton Eskimos, for crying out loud. That's their sixth in a row that they got that year, you know. In 1983, there you go. And I go from the worst to the Grey Cup to the best. And we go into BC, and we had a really close game with Hamilton. And it was a great event to win. And it breaks the 32-year non-winning streak of the city of Toronto, and it's probably the biggest parade, bigger than the Blue Jays. That they, after winning their two titles, and that it was just huge, and it was great history, and I'm so blessed to be a part of that.
And you should be. By the way, Chad Kaggart wants to wish you congratulations on going into the Hall of Fame.
That's terrific. All right.
You
know, all day today. Frank, all day today, it's been so nice, so flattering. You know, everybody has been calling and emailing, and it's like my birthday or something. Now, no, people don't call me on my birthday. It's just a very special day today. You know, the news got out, and yourself calling and inviting me to be on the show. It's just been a real special day for me to experience.
And let me say this for the folks that are out there. Dan has been working for his wife, the lady that we referred to earlier. Explain what your wife does and where you were all day.
Oh, okay, well, my wife is the executive director of Big Brothers Big Sisters of Halton. And her fundraising season starts now. And so today we had the Bowl for Kids Sakes program. So for the next 4 to 5 weekends, we kind of go to all these different bowls, and all these groups are very generous, and they bowl and for money, and they donate all the proceeds to the Big Brothers Big Sisters. And it's a big part of our fundraising. And tomorrow, so tonight we had the bowling. Tomorrow we have our 25th anniversary curling event here in Oakville at the new curling club, and we sold it out. It's a tremendous event. We're excited about tomorrow morning. So we and then Sunday we're back up into Georgetown to have another. It just becomes an action-packed weekends for the next little while for raising funds with my wife for Big Brothers Big Sisters. It's a great program, as everybody knows. It's a very well-known charitable cause. And I love doing it. I work with my old high school, Blakelock. We're raising money to help them get the facilities that they're the oldest high school in Oakville. Well, they're the Oakville oldest high school in Halton now, and they need help with facilities. Funding is changing, and the tax system is creating schools to become creative and raise their own funds if they want things to happen at their school. So I got involved helping them out, and it's working out really well. The opportunity that was given to me because I was a football player. Hey, you know, you're a celebrity. Can you come and do this? Can you do it? My gosh, you know, I got invited to all these events with all these different charitable causes, and I'm so happy that they got me involved. I was, with the Kidney Foundation, with diabetes, raised funds for the hospital, Oakville Trafalgar Hospital, the Red Cross. It was because of football that got me in the door, but it was because of my commitment and my enthusiasm about trying to help and raise funds and be a part of organizations and try to, do whatever you can in the community. So many people love doing it, then it works out. It worked out very well for me.
What is it about, it's always I've always been curious about what is it about football that transcends status, and by that I mean, you know, financial status, social status. It really does transcend it. There are so many stories where football has. Well, I'm not trying to suggest that it's a cure-all, but I am trying to suggest that it is a great assister of raising people's not just their consciousness, but their ability to transcend the tough breaks that maybe life has given them to begin with. What is it about football that does that, Dan?
Well, that's a great question. That's tremendous insight. You know why? What makes football unique is that 12 people come together to try to make one thing happen. And in those 12 people, everyone has just one little job. You know, as far out as that wide receiver is to just juke left and take his guy so far out of the picture that that's his job. And then the quarterback has all these reads, the offensive lineman, each one of them has something. When they talk about teamwork, when they talk about pulling together, football creates that opportunity. I'm not saying that the other sports don't have it, but I don't think it's as intrinsic of the game. I don't think it's as important for a success of a play. Everybody's got to do this job for one play to be successful. If anybody breaks down, the chain breaks and it's no good. So you have this learning process about football, and you're absolutely right. It has a uniqueness of all the other sports. It's a smash grab tackle.
Whatever you have to do.
Whatever you have to do to make it work. It teaches you so many things. You know, I love basketball and I love soccer, and I played all those games and I played them at high levels. But it was always football that kind of was that little extra, was something different. It was something that you were a part of. You could never be by yourself. You had to count on other people to be successful. And that's helped in every aspect of life, in working outside of football and working with the charities and things like that. You have to gather the momentum of others to be successful.
And not overrate yourself, because as important as the quarterback is, I don't think the middle linebacker is any less important on defense.
Well, you know, I always leave it to my kids to put me back in my place for sure. there's never a dull moment there.
No, hey, listen, you're preaching to the choir. I got four daughters, so, you know, the testosterone checks itself at the door.
Oh, no.
The toilet seat stays down in this house. It never
perfect.
Goes down.
That's all right. That's right. And nothing wrong with that.
Nothing wrong with it at all.
Oh, that's good.
You had the good fortune of playing in a lot of games. And for a short time, you got to play in the communities that you were referring to earlier, Saskatchewan. You played for Calgary. You played in the West. Help us understand from a player's perspective, and a vaunted player such as yourself, a Hall of Fame player such as yourself, going from the East and your home team, Toronto, and then playing in Calgary. What was that like?
It was very nice. By God. It was the equalization draft, and what it meant, what that meant was each team could only protect so many players, and everybody else was unprotected. And Ottawa, had been losing constantly for a long time, and they requested, you know, give them the opportunity, because everybody was hoarding the players, and they were never going to be able to break this losing streak.
Yep.
Yeah, cycle, exactly. I can't remember who the other person was, but me and one other guy were the two players of the whole league that got selected by Calgary in the equalization draft to help them come out of the doldrums. And OB called me right away, and I'll never forget. He goes, "Dan, you know, geez, you know, we didn't think they'd take you." I go, "What are you saying?"
And
he goes, "No, no." He goes, He goes, no, you know, you live right here in Oakville, and so you're, you know, really close to Toronto. You're never going to leave. And he goes, listen, you know, if you decide you don't want to go to Calgary, they'll probably, you know, release you, and we can get you back here. And I'm going, well, that's I'm not sure what I want to do anymore. But and so Calgary, they did the same thing Simon Fraser did. They called me, they booked flights, and they took me and my wife out, and they did this big recruiting thing for, you know, I'm in my, I guess my ninth year or eighth year, I can't remember, of football.
Yeah, you're not a rookie.
And,
Yeah,
and they're doing a recruiting job that I've been in Toronto. They don't, you know, they don't really do recruiting jobs. They, you know, they, it's a little bit different. And so I said, well, wow, you know, this would be really nice. And I got to go there, and I got, like, I don't know how many calls from all my friends from my days in Calgary. And it was a such a great experience. And the next year, the whole coaching in Toronto changed and everything. And Don Matthews, wanted to sign me back as a free agent. So it worked out well financially. It worked out well as far as personally with friends and with contacts and with just a great time that we had in Calgary. And that 1 year was very special and remember it often. We came back and, unfortunately, I'm here. It was the 89 was the opening of the Sky Dome. So that was the only thing I had missed from being out in Calgary. But a very special year. And you're absolutely right. Football out there is totally different. Like I said, I'm not sure. It doesn't have that competition like we have here, but it's rooted there, and they watch on TV, and it's a big part of the weekend. Like in Saskatchewan, they come from 300 miles. They may only get 26,000, but if you take the percentage of the community that gone to the football game, and you see the tumbleweeds because there's nobody else left in all the province. You know, it would represent like 100,000 going to a Buffalo game. Like, those are the numbers. So when people start, you know, crossovering numbers, well, they only get 26,000. Yeah, but do you know how much of a percentage that is of everybody that lives there? So Calgary, you know, they just it was a great experience, and it is. They, you know, that I'm not sure. Hamilton-Toronto has a tremendous rivalry, and I was a big part of that. And boy, oh boy, we experienced that rivalry a lot over the 12 years that I played. And it was always, it seemed like we were always playing them to see who was going to the Grey Cup.
Absolutely.
But Edmonton and Calgary at every level, hockey, football, politics, they are at odds, and they fight each other every step of the way. And that was an experience to learn about their rivalry and get to experience it. It was something special. So it's a uniqueness out there. It's when you see today the TSN TV, some of the biggest games are the Calgary and Edmonton games, Winnipeg too, and Saskatchewan. They have huge rivalries in that. And it's astonishing that in small numbered populist cities that they can pull in bigger fans than a Toronto game. And so it worked. It really, as you say, they do stand out. There is a uniqueness of football out west.
I understand also in Saskatchewan they have to have some pretty big parking lots because a lot of combines drive in. Some of their parking lots have troughs in them for the horses.
Yeah, they give them free access to the visitors' parking lot, too.
They have a lot of there. Okay, so you won the Cup in 83. You talked about the difficulties that Toronto were having in 81. You win the Grey Cup in 83, and you know, I'm getting old, so my memory is kind of – I did experience it. And people almost suggested that for the Argos to be successful, the biggest mistake they made in the 80s was they won the Grey Cup in 83. Do you remember that discussion? We're actually trying to say that the reason Argo fans stopped going is because they won the Grey Cup. They spent so many years dodging, you know, the Cahill years. You know, they missed so many years where they didn't win the Grey Cup, but never lost the enthusiastic fan. Until after 83. That must have been a weird thing to experience.
Well, you know, you say that, and it's really, to be honest, it's the first time I've heard it. But you know, when I got involved with the Argo management and being vice president and president, I got to learn the history of the Toronto Argonauts and what happens to teams after they win championships. You're absolutely right. There was this built up, you know, almost they were, you know, 2-14. We still had huge fans coming to the game, and they came to see us lose. They came to say goodbye, Leo, and Leo's been gone for a long time. You know, it was very unique. So in 83, when we do break that bubble and we do win it, there is a decline in attendance as the years go by, but it was a straight line decline. So I'm not sure it was the 83 Grey Cup. I know that there's a lot of discussion that happened. Like people don't realize that the CFL was more successful than the NFL. They paid more to their players, probably made more money in the 70s, in the very early 80s. And people are astonished to know that point. That's how we got so many guys to come up here and play here rather than play in the NFL. So, you know, the Bruce Clarks and and all those the quarterback that we had, he's a TV personality now. It'll come to me. Theismann, right? So all these guys, they all came up because the CFL paid more. And the reason why was our gates. You know, they were all large gates, and we had very little TV. And what happened was all the owners and the teams became very protective of the gate and started saying, you know, no, we don't want you to. If you show the game on TV, you know, there'll be 20,000 less people in the stands.
They won't come.
And they were absolutely right. If they got a chance to watch it on TV, they would stay home and watch it on TV, especially if the weather was bad. So at the closer to the end of the season for all the CFL, you'd see a lot of people staying in a nice warm living room rather than go to a game. So in that time, you know, a lot of people talk about we lost that era. We lost those young people. They were watching football on TV, but it was all NFL football. The parents were going to the games, and you know, we have you know, the Toronto Argonauts fan base, we have a very mature group. You know, when you look around, I know that some guys joke.
Yes,
that,
you do. I'm one of them. You whippersnapper.
Well, Argo, they say Argo fans are like Scotch drinkers. They're all dying out slowly. You know, you know, what happened at that point in time, I think that is a crucial recognition of the change of the marketability of the Argo. So as time went on and everybody started experiencing less and less gate, you know, and started to noticing the growth of the NFL in Canada, really they could look to TV as being, you know, the virtue to help that NFL grow to be what it was, with everybody trying to protect. I mean, I remember in the late 80s, they were still trying to protect their gate and worried about how, you know, showing a game. They would never show a local game. It was the, you know, the biggest mistake ever. And look what's happened. We show all the games all the time now, and we've seen a revitalization of the fan base in the CFL. A lot of teams are doing way better. You know, Toronto is always that anomaly, and I think more. I know you were saying how you like the Rogers Stadium, but I like Rogers Stadium too. And I'm not saying anything bad about it. But if the Argos had a stadium like in Montreal, like in Hamilton, like in Regina, where everybody's cozy, so when only 24,000 people come, you're still rubbing elbows with your fans. You're still getting excited.
It's not
in
so
Rogers
cool.
Stadium. In Rogers Stadium, if you have 24,000 or even 25,000, you know, close to 30,000, you still have this in my living room kind of space, right?
Dan. Let me help you out, Dan. It's like for the Toronto sports fans that went to the Grey Cup this year, like myself, when every seat is full and you're crammed in with other fans. There's no room to ignore the game. You can't lose track of it. The game is
perfectly set. Yeah.
The game is on top of you. There's nothing you can do about it. When I know this sounds stupid, but I think it speaks to your point. The more empty seats there are, the more distraction there is, as crazy as that sounds. And I'm grateful that you spoke to me because you actually fine-tuned what I was thinking. So in essence, if I can review what you said, basically what we're talking about here is when the CFL decided to black out games, which means not show them on air until the team was sold out. And, of course, none of the teams ever sold out, you know, realistically sold out. So they didn't broadcast the games. The people who were at home didn't have to worry about seeing the Argo game or going to the Argo game. There were seven NFL games on television. And that could be I think that's what I'm inferring from what you were saying. And that sounds pretty realistic when you consider, you know, the option was to sit at home and watch a game or remember. Because, you know, that's the tough part about being a fan, eh? Even when you are a fan, you got to remember when the games are, you know? And I'm joking right now with the CFL because they haven't released their schedule yet. You know, but to me, that's important. You know, release the schedule. Let the teams push the games that are happening. Let's all know what games are playing. Let's circle the ones that we want to go to. Or in the case of being a season ticket holder like myself, I know which days to block out and tell my wife we're not going out for dinner that night. You know what I mean? So that I can do that. But, you know, I just think that there's plenty of hope in the CFL. It's been a game that's been around for 140 years. It has great people like yourself who aren't just football players. You're leaders in the community, leaders in helping charitable organizations like you are now, helping in even as an executive. You've had your experience in the community working for the Y. You've had your experience being, my goodness, the vice president and the president of the Toronto Argonauts. The sport builds leaders, and the sport is a great game. It just needs an opportunity to shine. I don't think it'll ever get snuffed out. I think even if the NFL came here, I think it would probably be better for the CFL if they came here because we would get a firsthand glimpse at paying $300 to sit on the roof or $300 or $500 for a season ticket to watch the other game. And, I really do believe in the CFL. And the biggest reason why I believe in it is because of people like you, Dan. There are a lot of character people involved in the CFL. That's something that I want people to know and I want people to understand. So now you're a player. You go to Calgary to pick up where we were. You go to Calgary and you enjoy the experience of being involved in the Western Division. Now you come back to the Eastern Division. You've been a captain for the Argos for 10 years. How was it in your second coming here with the Argos? Was it any different? Oh, and by the way, you had experience of the John Candy, Bruce McNall, Wayne Gretzky experience, didn't you?
Oh yeah, no. It talked about a change of pace. So, I say to this day, if John Candy didn't die, he was going to take ownership of the Toronto Argonauts after Bruce McNall and Wayne Gretzky and himself kind of petered out. I think the Argos would be in a totally different position in the CFL. John Candy was just such a special person. So I thoroughly, one of my favorite years with the most experiences of my football career is 1991 with Bruce McDowell, Wayne Gretzky, and John Candy as the owners. I mean, it is hilarious. I mean, there's a game going on at Rogers Stadium, but I mean, there's like the jump in how many fans that came. They came to see, the Tom Cruises, the Sylvester Stallones, the Mario Hemingways. Janet Gretzky, like. In the locker room was just such a – it was such a great time, you know. Everybody – like I'm watching John Belushi in a movie before – you know, we all watched movies before a game. And I'm watching Mr. Destiny. And the next day out on the middle of the field, there's John Belushi and Dan Aykroyd, and they're – tossing the coin, and I'm just have watched them in the a great movie spend time before the game. That's how it was. You know, John Candy catching you in the middle of the Winnipeg hotel that we were staying in. Hey, Dan, come on, let's go get a bite to eat. You know, wow, John Candy. Hey, John, you know, I was about to go see my brother-in-law. I hope you don't mind. I can't make it. And to have him, like, really, like, wow, you know, sorry, we can do this another time, can't we? And you're going, wow, you know, you start feeling bad.
Yeah, yeah.
It was just... It was totally different. You know, to be able to experience that level of celebrities and things was very unique, you know. And I enjoyed absolutely every minute. And then we have that Cinderella ending. You know, you have the Rocket playing the best game of his life, and we win the 1991 Grey Cup.
Dodging beer bottles.
Down the things I am. And the coldest Grey Cup ever in the history of the Grey Cup. It really was a special year. The people that I played with, we had so many distractions, and it would have been very easy. Like the very next year, the team was almost exactly the same, but the uniqueness of 91 had disappeared, and I think they started hearing the stories, and it just broke down. So we go from breakup and we have a breakdown in the next year, a very difficult season for the Toronto Argonauts. So it was a special year. It was great to come back to. It was that was another great experience that I'm proud to be a part of. I wish everybody had an opportunity to experience what I got to experience in 1991. It was just a very special year.
Now then, that pretty much brings me to the next part of your life, and because you've had a very busy life, you are one of those people that licks the bowl of life. There is not a part of life that you don't want to experience. So as a player now, your career, you know that maybe you can't go out there to compete anymore. Now you decide, you know, maybe I'll be a coach. Tell us about the transition from being a player and becoming a coach.
Well, first of all, I never wanted to be a coach. I never, ever. And Pinball came, and I used to have a business in Oakville, and he'd come in, and he'd say, Dan, you know, would you like to coach the offense line? I go, Mike, I never want to coach. And then he'd come back a couple of days later. And Mike, I just love Mike Bidball Clemens. He's a special person. He always has been. And after I don't know how many times, he convinced me to become the offensive line coach. So, I thank him for it. It was a great opportunity. We had a lot of fun. We had I forget the running back, but he set a new record for rushing in the CFL. The offensive line was outstanding that we coached in, but I didn't want to coach anymore. Thank you, Peter. It was a great opportunity, but coaching is not something I want to continue. You know what? It was. If you think about coaching, it does take a special individual. There's only so many jobs, and there's only usually one job in one community. So if you work at a coach for the Toronto Argonauts, you have to leave Toronto, and I'd have to leave Oakville, unless I got lucky and just went over to Hamilton. But if that's what you want to do, at some point in time, you were going to have to pack up and move away. Well, you know, that was just not a lifestyle that I was looking to look at. It's been very good to a lot of people. But I like staying close to home with all my family and everything, and so that was an easy decision for me. They invited me to go up into the office in Sherwood Schwartz. What a great gentleman! The man lost more money than anybody else in the CFL, and he was so committed to a game that, you know, he knew very little about, but. He was a wonderful, wonderful man, and, you know, people misunderstood who he was. And I got to work with him, and it was, at a time that was very difficult. But, we brought in Garth Drabinski, and we tried all sorts of shows and halftime events, and we brought in Muhammad Ali, and we did everything. Like, there was no stone unturned. Garth Drabinski did anything and everything. He spent a fortune of dollars. It didn't really change how many people would come to a football game. That was the, you know, the one thing you learned about it. But everything was tried. There was no stone left unturned. And it was a great learning experience for me.
A little bit about Garth Drabinsky. He's the one that started the Cineplex, isn't he?
Yes.
Right. He was big into Broadway shows and entertainment. He was a Broadway producer. For the people that are listening, you know, it's not just a name. This is a guy that was entertainment other than sports. You know, if it was entertainment other than sports, it was a time when the Argos tried to marry sports with the other kind of entertainment. And as you're saying, it didn't seem to work out in the long run. Go ahead.
He was the top of the game. He was, you know, Les Mis, the Rap. He was. He'd won more Tonys than any other Canadian around. He was the top of his profession, and it didn't really have any impact on the Toronto Argonauts.
Yeah, and a shame for that. Now you experience being a player, being a coach, and getting involved in management. Then you get named in 2003 the team's president. How big a jump was that for you?
Oh, well, you know, I didn't even know I was team president. Somebody told me along the way. it was a very difficult time.
Oh my God! It wasn't one of those where they said, step forward if you want to be team president, and everybody stepped back.
That's right. I wasn't paying attention. Everybody stepped back, and there I stood alone. No, it was just something that, like I said, I had a lot of respect for Sherwood, and I had a lot of emotion for what he was going through and that. And so I just wanted to be a part of – There was no use to bring anyone else in. You know, we were going bankrupt. We were bankrupt. We were just going through the process in a proper way as we moved along. And it wouldn't have been fair to bring someone in to be a president or a vice president and give up a job just to know that, you know, there wasn't a lot of people that knew at what level we were at that point in time. So in taking over the presidency, it was really that there was just no other
option
to run it. So worked towards it. I remember one of the biggest projects was to find a stadium, because ultimately, in the end, the key to the Argos' success is to have their own stadium.
Absolutely.
They have to have other revenue sources other than selling tickets.
Absolutely.
It's going to be always difficult. Like at their budgets now, they have to kind of sell. You know, back then they had to sell 35,000 tickets to break even. So
but
we know how many tickets were sold, right?
And that's because they didn't get any money for parking. They didn't get any concession
that's
money.
That's right.
And that becomes the problem. And then they pay
yeah.
it like no, and, you're overhead. They're drowning in overhead.
Yes, that's exactly it. And that becomes the problem. So in having their own stadium and making it more intimate, of course, we have already talked about that, but that to be able to find sources of revenue outside of that, parking, concessions, you know, advertising, naming rights, you know, suddenly you're a business, you know, just like Montreal, he was able to turn around in a 22,000-seat stadium. He's done a great job out there. So it's that was a challenge, and if we could get a stadium, it would have worked out. But that was going to be very difficult, and it will remain to be a difficult move for them. I hope they can find something, because that would be the thing. If the Blue Jays do go to grass and won't allow any more football to be played in Rogers Stadium, they definitely need to find a new home.
Well, you know, I'm disappointed as always, and I hate to sound like a sports fan. Food before circuses sometimes is a little short-sighted. That theory is a bit short-sighted. I'm disappointed that with the Pan American Games coming here, they couldn't have squeezed out another stadium for Toronto as well as Hamilton. I don't pretend or portend to understand the dynamics of economics and stuff like that. But I do know one thing, and that is this is a giant metropolis here. And to suggest that you have one company controlling all the venues in the city is ludicrous. Because now with the sale of the MLSC to Rogers and Bell, Rogers has their fingers in every one of the stadiums in here. There used to be a time when monopoly was a dirty word. Now it seems to be a way of business, you know, vertical integration, if you will.
Yes.
I'd like to see the Argos have a stadium. And your point is not lost when it comes to a smaller stadium. Many times people have asked, why do the Boston Red Sox insist on only having 35,000 seats to sell? Well, because supply and demand is the rule. Now, if your supply is too big, the demand isn't big enough, and that lowers the price of each ticket. Whereas if the supply is under the demand, then those tickets can sell for a lot more. And you and I both know, as an athlete and a person who's been close to football, and I consider myself as a super fan, I know full well that if the seats are full, more people want the seats. If the seats are empty, nobody wants them. It's just that simple.
I agree with you 100%.
People are emotionally it doesn't matter anyway, because other people think it's important. Everybody, the joke is that when you were a teenager, when you and I were teenagers, you're much better looking than I am, but when we were teenagers, if we had a girlfriend, the girls were interested in us. If we didn't have a girlfriend, none of them were interested in us. It's just a factoid. It's not something I'm trying to say to sound whatever. I'm just trying to make a point. And the point is, everybody wants what everybody else has. If it looks like nobody wants it, then nobody wants it. So yeah, you're right that it would be fantastic if we could have 50,000 screaming fans in the Sky Dome to watch football. Because when I was there for the Grey Cup, Dan, it was the greatest feeling in the world. I could not believe that stadium and what it felt like in there. To me, and this, God, John, forgive me, don't punish me for saying this, even if the Argos had lost, it would have been a great experience. Because that stadium, it left me breathless seeing it full. And the energy level that when it's captured, when it's full, it doesn't dissipate because it's all connected. It's such a wonderful feeling. You're 100% right. I agree with you 100%. And that is the solution for the Argos may very well be a stadium of their own that doesn't have to have 50,000 seats, could have as few as 28, 26, 25,000 seats, and the people fill them and they're excited. And yes, God forbid we're outside. But, you know, God bless climate change. It isn't so bad anymore as it used to be.
Yes, I agree with that. I'm shoveling less snow than I thought I did when I was younger, that's for sure.
I feel like I was just finished preaching, and I don't like that too much.
And that, of course, was Dan Ferrone. Thank you for tuning in. We ran a little bit late, only due to the problems we had. We hope the whole show got recorded. Thank you for listening in.